I think Go, like you said, back-end web services, absolutely fantastic language, my go-to. I also think it's arguably the best language for most CLI applications.
Oh, over Python? Python's really popular. I think Go's better for CLI. It's more lightweight. I agree. Yeah.
Mariah Peterson. Am I saying that right? I'm so excited.
You are. You definitely are.
Okay, cool. You're from my neck of the woods. We're both here in Utah. You're here in Utah today, right? I'm assuming.
Oh, yeah. I'm at home. Spanish Fork, using my fiber internet.
Oh, Spanish Fork. I'm in American Fork. We've got all the forks of Utah covered.
There's only two.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, cool. This is so exciting. Obviously, I've met you here locally at Go Meetups, and I'm aware of the myriad things you do in the Go community, but I think we'll have a really interesting conversation. I'll try to keep it very kind of focused on community and Go and all the things, at least, that I know you for. But why don't you take just a second and introduce yourself?
Oh, sure. Yeah, so pretty simple. You already said my name. I've been in software for 5.5 years formally employed. It feels like everybody took a coding class in high school and it's like, oh, I can do this. And then, you know, like I had a couple of off jobs in college, but post college, 5 years. I have been professionally coding in Go for all of those 5 years. I have run Go meetups. I have spoken at Go conferences. I currently do live courses with O'Reilly on Go, Go web services. I've done Go memory patterns. I'm going to be doing Go data tooling soon. That's the next one that I have to write. so that'll be fun. And I also organize a local Go conference. Conferences are harder than meetups, but they're super fun. Yeah, I currently find myself kind of in the data space. I'm definitely a software engineer, not a data engineer, but I do work in the data stack. So my stakeholders, instead of being, you know, customers or paying people, they tend to be data analysts or data scientists, machine learning engineers, which has its own fun bottle of problems. But I really like data problems. I would rather query in SQL than write an API call. So I guess.
Yeah. So this is actually really interesting. And I want to call attention to this because I think I've had just hearing your story a little bit, it's very similar to mine. I don't know if that's just because we're both from Utah and like to write Go. But like most of my career is writing Go. And I always call myself a back-end engineer, but just a lot of the work tends to kind of be very data related, at least the companies around here. What is the difference in your mind between a back-end engineer and a data engineer?
That question keeps getting muddied the more and more AI companies get funded. Because the more AI companies get funded and the more money that goes into these data-centric tools, the less engineering is required for your data stack. Right? Like they're definitely more focused on enabling the data analysts or the data scientists, giving tools. It's the same thing you see in software, right? You can have somebody build their own website or you can just do it on Wix. Anybody can build a website, right? So it's the same kind of thing. So traditionally, data engineers are the people that, and I've like, this is like the definition since the beginning of computers. Data engineers are the people that built data sets and managed your enterprise data warehouse. So when I say building, like they are literally planning out how entities relate to other entities so that queries can be run efficiently. Ever since big data, this concept of the enterprise data warehouse has been muddied. And so it's become a lot more, how can we build pipelines? Mm-hmm. But very much it is using pipelines to construct data sets. Okay. So that is the traditional data engineer. It's all about constructing the data sets and how can you automate that construction of data sets. Whereas I see software more closer to building the services that you use for those processes. So, right. So when I say I'm a software engineer, but I like data, I would be building the software and systems used to manipulate those pipelines as opposed to worrying about how the data is interacted with in those pipelines. There's a lot of overlap.
Yeah.
But my headspace always goes to the system first and the data relationships second. So that's kind of how I still think like a software engineer, right? And a lot of software engineers, I feel like, always think about the system and sometimes forget about, like, they interact with databases all the time. Yeah. Always interacting with data. Data's everywhere, but where does the data sit in your mind? Is it the first thought, the second thought, the last thought, something you just throw away, you know, those kinds of things.
That makes sense. So you're seeing yourself as a software engineer that kind of dabbles in the data side, and that's primarily because you're actually writing the software that does the data processing rather than like maybe configuring the software or using the software. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Now, when you first explained data engineer, like, I don't know, a few paragraphs back in the transcript, you said something that made me think DBA. Like, it sounded like, if I squint, it almost sounded like,
I mean, it would have been DBA, right? They would have very much overlapped in the 80s and 90s. But DBA is not the same thing as a data engineer now, because it's no longer just interacting with the data warehouse, right? We're not just using Oracle databases at scale. It's very much about flow and automation. And that's not DBA, right? And I don't want to discredit a DBA, because DBAs are very specialized. And a lot of time data engineers do not have the tool set that a DBA has. Like, I could never be, like, I'm not a DBA. That's not my skill set. Can I manage a Postgres database? Yes. Could I manage a partitioned geo-global with all of the, no. No. Yeah. You know, like, I'm not going to say I am a DBA. And most data engineers I interact with do not have that skill set. They understand how data interacts, but they're not interacting with it at that kind of gigantic database scale. Like, databases are hard, and that's why we move to like things like Snowflake and BigQuery, where we don't deal with databases, we just use SQL. It's like, Snowflake's not a database. They store everything in like S3 and then they just run queries against it. Like, that's not a database.
Right, we're kind of abstracting all of the persistent layer behind this like nice SQL interface, right? And then, like, 100%. As long as we know how to query it, then we can kind of get stuff done. So I want to just dive into this a little bit, because I don't think we've talked about this yet on the show. And I think this will be really useful to some of the listeners. So when I like picture a DBA, I kind of imagine how it was explained to me in college, which I think is like a snapshot of maybe what a DBA was in the 90s, which is like, you've got one kind of monolithic database. Maybe it's an Oracle database. Maybe it's MySQL. And it's gotten like huge and hairy and complex. Like you said, it's like probably the central system for some enterprise, where you've got all your customers in there, you've got all your data in there, and your job is kind of to sit there and like run reports daily. Like, you know, different stakeholders in the business are coming to you and saying, like, I need to know XYZ about our users. Can you like come up with a SQL query and like generate a report for me? Is that how you're picturing the DBA role?
I mean, that's definitely part of it. But like, running reports can be done by any analyst at this point. I think a lot of what DBAs focus on will be what we classically would call operations. They're worried about the memory management of that DBA, of that database. Are the queries running in the most memory efficient manner? Can we optimize our queries? Are we dealing with query scheduling inside the database itself, worrying about stored procedures, making some, like, oftentimes they'll be redoing how the databases interact, making sure the relational model makes sense, sometimes breaking up models, doing different migrations. Sometimes it is down to like the hardware, like, oh, this server isn't big enough. I need to move it to a bigger server, and all of the steps that are required in that hardware migration. That's 100% within the skill set of a DBA, I would say, is that operations side of it. And on the cloud, that is a skill set I would never have. So
right. Totally different. And so a data engine, like moving to the data engineering side, like you said, it's much less kind of all those very specific database skills, but you said it's more about flow. And is that because it's like you're working with different cloud systems and you're moving data from one system to another? What did you necessarily mean by that?
A lot of it has to do with the fact that we have multiple data sources now. So something we commonly, I don't know if you've dealt with the concept of sources and sinks when you talk about data flow or eventing. But when you transfer data, you have a source, something that creates data, and then you have a sink, the place where the data is cached or stored. And you often in backend systems have many sources and sinks that interact in different ways for different caching mechanisms. What you add a layer of complexity when you do data engineering is now not only do you have these internal sources that you're trying to put either into a central sink or to a series of managed sinks, usually an S3 or a data warehouse or a, they used to use things like Hadoop for this.
Yeah.
You also have external sources, right? You're going to want your billing information, right? So whether that's managed through a bank or through a Stripe, you're going to have, advertising information, Google Analytics, you're going to have eventing information from your sentries or your segments or your Rudder stacks. You want to understand how customers interact with your data. You want to understand marketing analytics. You want to understand business. You want to understand finance, right? You're not just trying to figure out, is the thing up and running and alive? Or are we sending the API calls correctly? Or what's in the API calls, right? It's not just client data and metrics. It is now also all of the business functioning data. Everything to make the business run tends to flow into this thing and then be incorporated with that data we were using for that product too. So you end up having a multi-layered, like you can get multi-layered reports, but you have, again, the third-party sources, internal sources, sources from different departments. And then on top of that, you start layering permissions, right? Do you have protected identity, PII or PCI or HIPAA compliance or, you know, different kinds of data restrictions and permissions that you have to line on top of that and manage that affect your sinks? So it's like, can you store it in multiple places? So basically the multiple sources, where can they go and can everybody access them, ends up being those flows that you have to be aware of and manage.
We have to be careful. We're scaring everyone away. That sounded very complex.
This is why people do not do data problems. This is the kind of stuff that excites me. Like, I love that thing, which is why I tend to go to these data problems.
Yeah.
It's not for everybody, but yeah. It's fun for me, but but there's a definite need for people to do it, right? Like, we have a lot of data.
Every company has tons of data. So I want to kind of like play back what I just heard you say and try to like dumb it down both for myself and also
I said a lot of words, so we might need listeners. A summary.
So, okay. Data engineering from like a really high overview. You've got data sources. This is where data is coming from, right? Mm-hmm. So you mentioned third parties. So for example, on Boot Dev, we use Stripe for billing.
Yes.
So like I could be grabbing data from the Stripe API and like that would be a source, right? We might also have internal sources of data. So again, taking the example of Boot.dev, we've got students completing exercises. And every time that happens, that's an event. And I log that. Would that be like an internal data source?
100%.
Cool. And then I've got all that data coming in. And now when you said sink, we're not talking about kitchen sinks. We're like S-Y-N-C.
Like a sinkhole. Literally yeah. Like a sinkhole.
Oh, okay. And so that data needs to go somewhere. What, like, to give an example, like, what's one example of a place that data could be making its way to?
You know, I mean, if you're going to the big ones, people would throw them in a snowflake or a big quarry, a place that they could be accessed and quarried. You could throw them, if you're small, you can put them in a database. DuckDB is a great small SQLite-style analytics database. You can throw all of these things in, and then you could start to see how the data relates to each other, and it can give you a picture, right? Like with your thing, if you're talking about Stripe and then your usage, you can start seeing things like, okay, how many of these courses are completed by paid users versus free users? And you can start saying, hey, maybe I want to grow this segment, or wow, we've seen a lot of growth in our free users. Do we want to convert them to paid users? Maybe you don't want to convert them to paid users. Like, there's different things you can see once you start relating those two.
Right. That makes a ton of sense. Okay. So all this data is kind of going into a database, or I think you used the word data warehouse.
Data warehouse or a data lake. Yes. So database is a relational data store. A data warehouse, traditionally, right back in the 90s, was a columnar query data store. So basically, it's a different way of scheduling your SQL queries. And then another common one is called a data lake. And this is basically just anywhere you can throw data. So things like S3, things like cloud data store, they're called high-density file stores, HDFS. So it's basically just places you can put raw files where they can be accessed. And then you can put query layers on top of them.
Yeah, not necessarily like optimized for fast, like transactional
queries.
No,
they're not optimized at all. It's like at that point, you're optimizing for how much you can store over how quick you can access it. Warehouses tend to do how make it easier to access and not worried about how much you can store. And then databases are the 100% fast access of small amounts of data.
Got it. So for like your typical, let's just say software as a service company, SaaS company, say we use like Postgres for our backend, like the database for our application.
Your services itself. Yes.
Yeah. Like, would we typically want to shove like all this kind of data lake type information in there, or do you usually keep that separate?
I would want to keep it separate. One, because stuff you use tends to have different access levels. I mean, this is a weird security style situation. But I know when you're building a web service, the last thing you want is some random developer querying in production and taking the database down.
Yeah.
But if you're doing analytics, you want people querying that production style data. You want the live data. You want the real data.
Yeah.
I mean, you typically clean things out. Like, you're not giving people access to emails or to addresses or to social security numbers. Like, that stuff's gone, right? We've cleaned it up, so it's a little bit more anonymized. But they need access to what is live. So you wouldn't want that in the same database that your services rely on. So that's why you would turn to a data lake, right? You might say, okay, well, once a day, I'm going to run a job that copies, you know, the last day's data, puts it in a file and dumps it to my data lake so that the analysts can query it later and have the last day's analytics based on our SaaS products usage.
Got it. And so as a back-end developer that does data work, or as a data engineer, you'd be writing the software that takes that data from the source, like you said, maybe cleans it up, anonymizes it, maybe removes emails, 100%. And then dumps it somewhere.
Yeah.
Okay, very cool. And this is the stuff you love, I guess.
In a weird way. Unfortunately, yes, this is the stuff I love.
I like it too, actually. Like, I know I'm like asking all of these questions, but this is what I've worked in roughly for the last decade, and I enjoy it as well. I really struggle building UIs. I really like writing functions that transform data. It's just a simpler world for me.
Yeah, I agree. I don't like making things pretty. I like making things run fast.
Yes, run fast. I love that. Okay, now I want to zoom out a little bit. So we've talked about, I mean, we've like table stakes, defines some of this back end, this data stuff. Obviously, you said you've been working in Go for about 5 years professionally. I want to go back to the beginning because I did some digging before the episode started and I found out that you have a bachelor's degree in physics.
Oh, I do.
A, like, I guess why? And then B, why, like, if, well, let's just start there. Why a bachelor's degree in physics?
I mean, it's not because I'm a masochist. A little bit. I a little bit wanted to torture myself. I really like physics. Like, when I was going into college, trying to figure out how the world worked and why it worked that way was just my life's goal. Like, I graduated with that. I started grad school. And I was like, I was going to get my PhD in physics. Like, that was my whole thing. And then, you know, the story I tend to tell people, because it's a little bit less depressing, is I only went for one semester because during that first semester, they were doing the mandatory careers course. They're like, what are you going to do with your PhD after you've been in this program for 7 to 10 years? And I was like, 7 to 10? I thought it was 5. And they're like, here are your options. You could be a professor, but none of the professors now are going to retire, so you'll never have a job as a professor. You could go work in a private laboratory and run experiments for the government that are classified, or you can be a software engineer. Those are the pretty much only careers for physicists. And I'm like, I'm not a software engineer.
They listed software engineer? That's kind of crazy.
They had, at the time, most professional data scientists at, like, the big companies had PhDs in mathematics or physics.
Okay, yeah.
Because building machine learning models is hard. Like, the research for machine learning models is hard. Using machine learning models, training machine learning models is very different than the research for the machine learning model.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if you go to physics and you look at people's pedigrees, a lot of them have PhDs in math, statistics, or physics because they all have an overlapping skill of advanced calculations.
Yeah. So it's interesting, though, that they said, like, software development, or I'm guessing
they definitely didn't understand the landscape. Right. These professors, okay, they want you to be a professor, even though they know there are no jobs as professors. Like, I was groomed is the wrong word, encouraged in my undergrad to get a PhD. Like, they wanted you to go to graduate school. They wanted you to get a PhD. You studied physics. You have the passion to get a PhD, and that to them is the only true option. It's kind of a little bit religious. But for the people that fail, that are not selected by the divine, they can go work in software. And the truth of it is, within 2 years, so I left after one semester, got a job within 3 months because the market was such that they needed people who could speak intelligently. Like, that was my skill at that point in time. I went back to go see my undergraduate advisor within a year. And he said, can I ask how much you're making? I told him my salary. He said, that's how much I make. And I was like, well, looks like I made the right career switch. Cause yeah, if my cap, and he'd been teaching for 20 years.
Yeah.
If the cap was $100,000 for a university professor, that's quickly not going to be a livable salary. Like, right, just honestly,
yeah,
you're not buying a house with $100,000 in the market in Utah right now.
Yeah, it sounds like the real golden ticket was not being picked by the divine.
Not being picked by the divine lets you afford a house and food. So yes,
yeah, this is cool. So you're the first person I've had on the podcast with a degree in physics, but a lot of my guests have had, yeah, like, degrees in all sorts of things that aren't software development, right? Electrical engineering, math, like, it's all over the place. And a lot of folks I've found are finding their way into software development, whether it's data engineering or backend development or web development. Just, you know, we need smart people in the industry. Like, and that's basically the bar. Like, Are you smart, and are you willing to put in the work to learn all this stuff?
Oh, it's definitely not easy, I think, but a lot of the motivation to keep learning, right? Like, and I don't know how well they sell this to people coming in. A lot of people will, I have a nephew who's attending a boot camp right now, and I'm really trying hard to make sure that the boot camp's not overselling expectations.
Yeah.
I pretty much tell him, you're not going to get a job. Like, just because that's the market right now. Like, you're not getting a job.
The market's rough. Yeah.
But like, the truth of it is, when you walk out of that boot camp or that 4-year college degree, you don't know anything. You do not know enough for that job. But can you prove through your interviews you're willing to continue to learn for your entire career? Great. Now you're hireable. And if you have a degree in physics, that's not a skill. That's not something I have to defend. People know, oh, clearly this person really likes to learn because they learned too much in their undergrad. Like, they spent too much time in the books.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. So my perception of this has been, like if we rewind to, like, 2018, 2019, definitely 2020, we had a tech bubble, like, in general, and hiring was out of control. But a lot of, like, I don't know, tech influencers, just people online talking about how easy it is to get into the tech industry. And I always have kind of pushed back against that because
it's the, like, opposite of easy.
I was hiring at the time and I would see how many people were applying for jobs that I had to turn away, right? So and a lot of those people, you know, were self-taught or bootcamp graduates. So, you know, at Boot Dev we always talk about this, but, like, it's going to take longer than you think it's going to. But if you keep making consistent progress, you can absolutely
100%. You have to keep making progress and like, great. So you start in tech support, find a company that lets you start in tech support and work up. There are companies that do that, that is their preferred way of promoting people to software engineering. Like, maybe they don't hire entry level, but they do promote to entry level. Like, if that's the way you do it, that's an amazing route, because then when you start the entry level job, you have the domain knowledge to focus exclusively on learning software.
Yeah.
Best practices. Like, it's totally fine. And the other thing I agree with is that you said is it's not hard to get a job in the tech industry once you have a job in the tech industry. It's that first job that somebody has to take a risk on you. And that risk will either fail completely or pay off. I got lucky. Somebody took a risk on me. You got lucky. Somebody took a risk on you. And you have to prove yourself that's what people don't say. It's like, it's the entry level jobs that are hard to get. Senior jobs are easy. Like, even though the market's hard, there's still a lot of senior level jobs. Like, there's definitely few less than there was, but there's still a lot.
Yeah, tech is a newer field, and we don't have this, like, you know, if you go look at the trades, for example, there's, like, this very kind of structured path that you go from, like, you know, I think you start as, like, a journeyman, right? You work as an apprentice, and you kind of work your way up, and there's this way to get in. Like, tech has moved so fast. Like, we don't have any structure to this. Like, it's exactly like you said. You're literally just out there trying to get someone to take a chance on you so you can get a few years of experience under your belt. And then once you have that, people be like, oh, like, somebody paid you for 2 years to write software? Like, you must at least be this good. Like, so I'll hire you, right?
Yes. It gets so you much have 2 years of experience? Oh, good. Now I can hire you. And we'll, yeah. Like, it's insane how it just, that it speaks for itself.
Yeah, but, like, I was talking about, it was a few episodes back with a guy who streams on Twitch. His name's Trash Dev. He was talking about how.
Oh, from Netflix.
Yes. Yeah.
I watch his streams.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, I was talking about how, like, a lot of the people I've interviewed, and I should actually just ask you as well, had, like, really weird first jobs. Like, Netflix wasn't his first job, right? Like, he was doing, like, mainframe programming. I was writing Go that ran on Raspberry Pis for my first job that, like, we installed on bridges to, like, read. Like, it was just weird. It was just weird stuff. Like, it wasn't this sexy, like, FANG company. What was your first job?
I
have to tell us the name of the company if you don't want to, but just, like,
no, the first, how was the, it? The, yeah. the, my first post-college job at NAV was a fantastic job, and it was literally writing Go microservices. Like, it was the on,
oh, it's amazing,
that were deployed to Kubernetes on AWS. Like, it was literally the ideal job.
Way to disprove my point. All right.
In college, I did have a job working for the university doing QA, and then it magically turned to web development halfway through my tenure yet there, where I did QA for their Cold Fusion site. And then we switched to doing development on Drupal, we were migrating raw PHP sites to Drupal. And I did not like any of, the QA was fine. I was fine doing QA. Like, I'll click buttons and write a line of yeah. Cold Fusion. Like, that's fine. Drupal migration, that was stupid.
That's like, the one. That's the job I was referring
that's,
to.
That's the yeah. one I quit to go. I made more money. I quit that job to go make more money TAing physics.
Oh, wow. Yeah. My first software development job, I was paid $15 an hour.
Okay, I didn't make that much in college, but I did make more as a physics TA than I did migrating Drupal sites.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty crazy. But I mean, I was also in college at the time. And like, it's
but
just,
you weren't
yeah.
working for the university, were you?
No, this was a different company. Yeah.
Universities like to underpay people.
Yeah, that's what I've gathered, I guess, is the way
but
I'll
then,
say it.
I don't know. It was nice. I could do homework at work, so we'll just leave it at
yeah,
that.
That's true. I couldn't do that. I actually was pretty busy
that's the
all
one. The main benefit of being a TA was doing homework at work.
Okay. Yeah, that's cool. So after that job, you got this job doing Go microservices. Did you get that job because you were interested in Go, or did that job get you into the Go community?
That job got me into Go.
Okay. And like now in my mind, you're like the poster child for Gopher Utah or Gophers Utah. Like,
I am the poster child for Gopher Utah. That's 100% accurate. What I am. I literally brought gophers to the last Go meetup to hand out. So, that is what I am. The story for that is I went to the first GopherCon. Somebody gave a talk about meetups and I was like, oh, I'll just start a Women Who Go meetup in Utah. Why not? And like literally within a week, I'd started that meetup. And so because I don't have any chill. and so, yeah, I just started meetups and then I quickly took over the Go meetup. And then I quickly took over a bunch of other meetups and then I started a Go conference. So, there's a great Go community in Utah, but it's still a lot. There's a lot of experience, but there's a whole lot more people who are new to Go or want to experiment with Go. And I just really want them to know Go the right way. Like, I don't like Java Go. Java Go is disgusting. I don't like Ruby Go, which is also Java Go. Like, there's a lot of bad ways to do Go, and I saw a lot of bad ways to do Go, and that's what I don't want. So that's kind of why I got involved in all these meetups. And we're definitely a lot better. At least the people that show up to the meetups are doing a lot better.
I loved the meetup. I need to get back to the meetup again. I went to a bunch of Go meetups.
I mean, I'm speaking at the next one. So come in
September. I just pulled it up like a couple hours before we hopped on this call. I'll be there.
Okay.
Okay, so we're going to talk about the community in just a second, but you said something that was really interesting to me, and I want to jump into it. You said Ruby Go and Java Go, and at my first Go job, it was Ruby Go.
I'm sure
so,
it was.
Yeah, I mean, Utah also has a lot of Ruby on Rails shops, or at least it did back then.
I think that had to do with the timing of the startups in Utah.
Yeah, I think so too. Very much like Basecamp style, 37 Signals, Ruby on Rails. So what to you, like, what do you see the most when you see people coming into Go from either Java or Ruby, whichever one you have seen more of? Like, what are some of the common mistakes?
The biggest, what I like to call is over-abstracting. When you come from a language that's heavily object-oriented, you want to take those practices into Go because they've been trained into you. And Go's not object-oriented. Essentially, every time you add a layer of abstraction, which would be a layer of inheritance in your object-oriented, right? The things they teach you to do to make your programs better. Every time you add a layer of that in Go, you essentially decrease the performance of your code for something that you claim to be more readable, which in Go does not always make it more readable. Because Go does not have classes, they don't have the same kinds of inheritance patterns that you see in these typical things. They basically have structs, which are a type, basically a nested type where you can add multiple types. And then they have interfaces, which is a way of defining a contract of behavior. Those are the only two things. And people overuse interfaces and they overload interfaces. And then they overuse structs, right? Just define one struct and use it everywhere. Like, yeah. The compiler will inline the import for you. The more times you are changing types, so like a lot of people, what they like to do is they like to have packages which are now titled modules. They will have a new struct type in each module for your data set. And they're like, this is inheritance. And it's like, no, every time you do that, what you're doing is you're rewriting the memory footprint of the same data that you're using everywhere. But if you use the original struct type, that doesn't have to be rewritten into a new memory format every time you call it. You can keep the same memory footprint and the same allocation. You don't have to redo that and just add bulk that the garbage collector has to clean up. I mean, a lot of people don't notice it because of how fast Go is as a programming language. But it could be faster. It could be more efficient, and it could it could have fewer bugs because you're reading there's less boilerplate, there's less copying of data. Like when you get down to the bits, like there's just too many bits floating around, and you're overworking your garbage collector. And not again, the garbage collector's flawless. Like it's not like it's making bad programs that you won't notice when you're doing microservices at all. But it just can lead to things you don't see. And it could be better.
Yeah. It's really interesting to hear you talk about the performance side, because, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. But it's also like something I wasn't even really thinking about when I was looking at these programs. To me, it was just like, wow, I can't read this stuff. This doesn't look like Go code.
I mean, the biggest problem 100% is readability. But Go's a compiled language. I mean, it's... people come into art readability and white space arguments, and I'm like, I don't like to make that argument because Go's compiled, so who cares? Right, Ruby, Python, they're not compiled languages. They're script. They run in a runtime and they run step by step. So it does matter how many lines of code, and it does matter how it's formed. Like those kinds of Go doesn't matter. So how many lines of code you have, how much boilerplate at the end of the day doesn't matter to the compiler, but it does matter how many bits you're writing in the heap versus the stack. Now, does this matter to a junior engineer? No, just write Go. Go's great for writing big things. It does matter though, when like you start getting, maybe you forgot to close a row on your API request. And now you can't see it because of all the boilerplate. You're trying to figure out why do I have 12 different microservices for this. I keep running out of memory, so I keep spilling up new pods. Why is this? Well, you can't find it. You're not going to be able to find it because you have so much boilerplate. You just know that the memory keeps ticking up, and maybe it's activity, maybe it's not. And it's definitely, yeah, that's definitely where my mind's been at. Also, I keep having this conversation. I'm jealous of people who worked in the 90s because in the 90s, they didn't have gigabit RAMs. Like they didn't have this unlimited concept of memory that people like you now. So they had to think about algorithms and link trees and how to run memory efficiently. Like even on a Raspberry Pi, I just bought a Raspberry Pi with an 8 gigabit RAM. Like I'm never going to kill that. But that's what if my embedding was megabytes? Then I would care. And we need to, like, I'm not saying everybody needs to think that way, but it's a good thing to have in the back of your head. Am I running this the best way possible? How can I make it more efficient? Like, if you want to build the best software, what can you do to make it the best? I'm not saying you need to take it to 100% performance, but maybe 80%. Can you make it the 80% best performing software it can be? Great. Well, that's the difference between mid and senior sometimes. Like it'll help you. Yeah. Like it's just a way of thinking that helps you in your career to advance. And it's just something that's been on my mind a lot.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I think so. I spend some time on tech Twitter.
I'm sorry.
The eyebrows raising. And something you'll hear a lot on tech Twitter, because tech Twitter by my estimation is heavily skewed towards like people that want to work at like startups or start their own thing. And so a lot of the advice to developers is like, we don't need performance. Like, we're just trying to get our MVP off the ground, which, like, that's good advice if you're starting a startup, or like, that's good advice if you work at a 3-person company that's, you know, just building a CRUD app. But I love the fact that you're talking about performance, because for most of us, like, for most of us that just get back-end jobs at like medium to large companies, like, we do need to think about that, because these companies do have lots of users or are moving lots of data.
100%. And I'm not saying, oh, I need not working on the edge systems where, or, you know, you'll hear these stories, people who work at like something like Walmart, where you're dealing with thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars in transactions, and their optimizing their edge services can literally save them millions of dollars. I'm not talking about those millisecond optimizations that you get in those high performing companies. It's literally like, oh, can I get taking 1 second to run my API call to maybe milliseconds, yeah. Not saving your, oh, going from 5 milliseconds to 10 milliseconds to save me $50 million. Like, that's not the kind of, That is a special kind of optimization where I think people are specialized in doing that. But I think that's different than writing high quality code. And writing high quality code is taking it from, oh, this takes a 20 seconds call to now it only takes milliseconds. And you don't always see that in Go. In Go, it's always going to be milliseconds because, again, Go is fast. But you can still make it, you know, maybe a 20% improvement without having to go to the extreme practices.
Yeah. Well, I mean, sometimes it's surprising when you do find like that critical path that's causing something to be slow. Like, sometimes it's as trivial as just like, you know, I'm doing some IO. I'm like going to disk like sequentially in a loop over and over and
that
over again.
That oftentimes is the case, is you're doing an IO write, which could be caching a file, writing to a database. I mean, it almost all logging too much. That's almost always the case because that takes up the most, but how is that different than writing too much to your stack memory and having the garbage collector clean it up?
Right.
I mean, it's besides the fact it writes to stack faster, right? Great.
Yeah.
But it's the same process, right? Are you writing too much, or could you be just having a best practice of not writing too much, which gets you away from a lot of this extra abstraction that people used to OOP put into Go. I'm not saying you shouldn't use interfaces. Use interfaces. Use structs. Just, they should be used the Go way, which is the way the compiler expects them to be used.
Right. A thing I often ran into, like you said, kind of Ruby Go. A lot of developers coming from Ruby, starting to write their first lines of Go, was like way overusing like just the empty interface.
Right? Oh, I'm
like,
sure.
Oh, I have this thing, and man, it would be really convenient if I could just like use it everywhere. So I'm just going to like unmarshal some JSON as the empty interface, right? And then later when I care about the fields, like we can do some like custom unmarshaling or some crazy, like I saw that kind of stuff all the time and it drove me nuts. It's like, you know what the JSON, like,
if you know what the type's going to be, especially with JSON, it's already using it. The library already uses the empty interface. Build the freak, and this is ape. Why are you? It's a basic principle. It's not good Go. It is good API contracts. Like, this is a design problem. This is much higher level than just writing code that I don't like. This is like, we have a contract. We know what we expect. Let's just define it and do what the compiler expects us to do, which is using hard typed variables.
Define a struct, right? And like unmarshal into it. Yeah.
100%. That's what the compiler expects. And that was, again, the big argument for generics in Go, which I knew people don't use generics, use hard types. Like, I think the only time you should use generics, the Go language is using them amazingly to optimize the compiler. I think that's great. I think they have library tools. If you're working on an open source project, you'll see it. If you're building microservices that have defined behaviors, err on the sides of typed with contracts and be done with it.
Yeah, it's funny. I literally wrote an article, I think, 3 days ago about this, where it was like, if you're building libraries, right? If you're building something that's going to be used in hundreds of applications, I think generics are super useful, right? Mm-hmm. But if you're writing application level code, you should be using them quite sparingly, because when you're taking data from like when you're unmarshaling an HTTP post and shoving some of that data into a database, it's all hard types. Like everything
it's
you 100% know is
API dependent, right? Like you have an API for your database, which is the database schema. You have an API for your request, which is the JSON payload you expect, right? Because what do you do when you get a payload you don't expect? You say bad request, like you throw back a whatever 400. It's like great, like give you them the 400 saying this does not match the contract that I specified in my API docs. This is not valid JSON I expect. Great. Just use this API contract, which is, again, something I wish I knew early on was the importance of just designing a good API with contracts. That's the only part of API design I think you really need. There's a lot of nuances to API design, especially when you're doing public APIs. But if you're just doing back-end inter-service, get a contract and stick to your contract. And when you need to change your contract, make sure that you, like, that's between teams. That's when you show your communication skills and prove that soft skills matter to back-end developers.
Right. That's when software engineering actually, unfortunately, gets hard. It's when you have to communicate with humans.
When you have to use those soft skills and talk to other teams. Yes.
Cool. Okay, I've got some hot take type questions lined up that I really want to get your opinion on. So the first one, this might be easy. Like, what's your favorite part of Go? Like, what would you be most sad if it changed?
If Vim Go quit working, I do Go in Vim, and I really like a lot of the stuff in that I can do with Vim Go. Copilot's taken away a lot of the stuff because Copilot like generates everything for me, so. But I guess I like the third party tooling in Go. I like the fact that I can go use a Qi API framework and have good third party open source support for that. I think Go has a great set of tooling outside the standard library. And I don't want the standard library adding too much and taking away the freedom that non-Google paid developers have for building tooling in the ecosystem. Whether that be Vim Go that I love, or the Goji framework, or Spew.dump is a great one. DBX is one I use all the time. SQLX is what I mean. SQLX is okay. I use it all the time.
I've like, used SQL C. I don't think I've tried SQLX before.
SQLX is lets you specify struct tags on your structs.
Okay.
So you can unmarshal to struct. So it's tooling on top of the SQL interface that just allows you more dynamic. If you like actually querying the database, SQL C is fantastic. SQL X. SQL C I did a whole thing on it for my O'Reilly course. I like SQL C. It's the reverse solve to the problem, right? Can you generate your API with SQL, or do you need to, where SQL C lets you generate the API with functions where you add your own SQL.
Got it. I'll definitely need to check it out because I'm always interested in the different ways Go developers are interacting with databases, because it's not like a mature space yet where like everyone's doing the same thing.
No, So I was for Postgres, I see a lot of people doing SQLX or PGX. Those are the two popular Postgres third-party libraries.
Cool. I'll definitely check those out as well. I've been using SQL C a lot recently just because I've been on a SQL kick.
It's great.
It's fun. Cool. Okay, so that we got your favorite part, third-party support. What's your least favorite part? What would you change if you had godlike powers to just reach into the language and change something?
What would I change about Go? I don't know if I would change anything. Like, I don't No, because everything I would want to change about Go, I just go do in a different language, honestly. Like, for a long time, I would push. I'm like, I wish Go had better math libraries so we could do machine learning in Go. And now I'm like, I'll just go do machine learning in Rust because they have better C++ bindings. Like, yeah. I don't know. I think Go has a really good tool set for web services and for distributed system tool, like that cloud data, like the Kubernetes and the Docker and the, all those things that are built in Go. I think Go is really optimal for that. I don't want Go expanding too much to things it doesn't make sense for. I know there's a push for, there's a tiny Go repo that's now supported by the Go team for Go on IoT. The tiny Go's fine, but I would use Rust. Like, I think Rust has, is a much better, because you don't have to take the garbage compiler, the garbage collector with you. Right. And then people are like, well, like, sometimes I'll do, like, for front end, people are like, oh, you can use, I'm like, Go JSON was a thing. There was like JS Go. It's like, just don't use Go for front end. Like, just don't.
Yeah,
that's the thing. I don't want them to add things outside, like the other languages already shine in. I don't think we should compete with other languages. I think we should just be the best language in the space we're in.
I agree. I think Go, like you said, back-end web services, absolutely fantastic language, my go-to. I also think it's arguably the best language for most CLI applications.
Oh, over Python? Python's really popular. I think Go's better for CLI. It's more lightweight. I agree.
Yeah. Yeah, and like, to be clear, not necessarily for scripting, like not necessarily for like not just writing like 5 lines of script.
Scripting is different.
Yeah.
Scripting is different, yeah.
I mean, like, compiled CLI tools that like you can install, right? Like, that's what I like Go for. You don't have to specify Python versions and things like that when you want to distribute it to users.
You don't have to install with Python. You can just literally download the binary and have it in your path, and it's done. The end.
Yeah. Those are by far my two favorite things. So you said you'd like use another language, and it's hilarious. This is my next question on my kind of hot take question list is, what are some instances, or maybe like what's the best example of a time where you've been doing something and you've been like, maybe Go wasn't the right choice for this thing I'm trying to do. Was it the embedded systems with Rust, or was it something else?
Okay, I haven't done it. There's a lot of things I think Go would be, but I don't do those. I pretty much only do Go. I did machine learning in Go, and then I quit doing machine learning. So like, maybe I'm too like hardcore.
So it wasn't that you solved the problem in another language. You just opted not to solve the problem and solve a different problem.
And so, and a lot of this is just a ridiculous branding, I think, for me, right? Like, I would stream on Twitch. I'm a Go streamer. I speak about Go. So it's like, maybe it's a Mariah problem. Where when I see a weak spot, I just don't pursue the weak spot. I just go back to safety. But yeah,
it's great.
I think
personal branding. Yeah.
Great personal branding. So yeah, that's mostly if I ever do data and analysts and analytics, or do I'll go do a Python pandas.
Okay, yeah.
I've done some of that in notebooks, but I don't do that much data analytics. So
yeah, probably because you can't use Go to do it, or at least it would be not.
I mean, not the way I want to. No, not as dynamically.
Yeah. Okay. Last hot take, what's your most unpopular engineering opinion? So just like any engineering opinion.
My most unpopular, I don't have unpopular opinions. Everybody just does what
I say.
You're
just mainstream?
So right now, this used to be more unpopular than it is. It's gaining traction. But for a long I said it first. I don't think we should use Python for data engineering. I think we should be building data systems, and I don't think a lot of people, they'll use Python as config scripts, and I'm like, no, JSON YAML. We have, just look at the engineering space. We have proven that if you're writing configs, it's JSON or YAML. Like all of the tools, Kubernetes, every cloud native, every cloud tool is JSON or YAML. Like your configs are JSON and YAML. Don't be using Python for configs. Don't be like, so if you're not doing that, then you're using Python to write scripts.
Yeah.
Or you're using Python, which a lot of the scripts should be written, like they're bash scripts, like they're cron jobs. Like a lot of, you could do bash, and then if you're building systems, don't do Python. Like just don't do Python. Don't build services in Python. They're like, oh, we'll put this model behind an API. Okay, fine. That's the extent of you trained the model in Python. Great. You threw an API around it. Great. That's the extent of the Python, yeah, because you have to use Python to interact with the model. That's it. That's that's not data engineering. That's deploying a model to production.
In my past, we generated the model with Python, and there's actually really good support to read the model in Go.
If you're using Onyx, yeah, you can. 100%. Yeah. Like, I'm not saying don't do that. If you can inference in another language that's faster than Python, great. But yeah, that's my thing. Another one, do not deploy notebooks to production. You'll see a lot of people. We can make our data scientists more productive if we deploy their notebooks to production. It's like, no. Do you understand the compute model of a Jupyter notebook? You're literally deploying thousands of containers in one service. Like, that's how it works. It's a kernel model. You have one Linux kernel for a reason. You don't need 1,000 Linux kernels to be deployed to run one script.
You're angering every data scientist.
No, I am angering people that are trying to save money by enabling data scientists. Data scientists don't want to deploy anything to production. They don't.
That's true. Yeah.
So just give them engineering resources. That's it. That's what I'm saying. If you want something in production, don't save money by making the data scientists do it. Save money on your freaking infrastructure cost by having an engineer do it.
I like those takes, and I tend to agree. Like,
they're too popular.
Yeah, they've definitely become popular because, yeah, I look at it as like Python's great for data science, but not for data engineering. I think Go is really good for data engineering.
I mean, Rust is gaining huge ground in data engineering right now, yeah, mostly because it's not Google sponsored. Like, it has its own Rust Foundation, right? It doesn't have a company backing it, which I think is...
was good until the whole Rust Foundation fiasco,
people aren't paying attention to that. Okay. I know what you're saying. But when you have a field that's so heavily influenced by academics, data science and machine learning is very heavily influenced by academics. They don't want companies involved. I think that's one of the reasons why Python has had so much traction there.
Which is actually interesting because, I mean, I love the fact that Python's like taken over in academia, because before it was MATLAB, which was like the worst. It was completely proprietary. MATLAB. Like, oh no, Mariah, that was your unpopular opinion. That was the big one.
I'm a physicist. We lived in MATLAB.
Yeah,
but I went to do my PhD and they didn't use MATLAB, and they're like, do your differential equations in Mathematica. I'm like, again, you guys have no clue what computing is. Mathematica will kill your memory. Use MATLAB. It's made for computers.
I can't compare it to Mathematica. I've never done that. But
don't. But MATLAB, yeah. MATLAB, you're right. It's very proprietary, but it depends on the calculations you're doing. I have never seen numeric calculation support like I do in MATLAB. But you don't necessarily need that when you're doing machine learning, right? Like, you're not numerically computing differential equations. You're analyzing data. So it's a very different... I'm not saying build machine learning models in MATLAB. Don't do that. I'm not saying do linear algebra in MATLAB. I just...
Yeah. That makes sense. There's good. I finally coaxed a perhaps truly unpopular opinion out of you, at least for those of us that didn't come from traditional sciences.
I still have my university. I don't know when they're going to kick me off of my university alias. They clearly don't police that. I haven't been in college for five, six years. Yeah, so I still have university licenses for MATLAB if I wanted to. I haven't downloaded them. I am ethically responsible as a non-student of 6 years. But, you know, I get the emails to my alias, come download the new version of MATLAB. And I'm like, I'll use Python. Like, I don't need order of magnitude accuracy.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Cool. Those were great. All right. The last thing I have for you is regarding the tech community. So I want to ask you about, should people who are just getting into the field, so they're like starting to look for that first job in backend engineering, should they be interested in like podcasting, blogging, speaking, meetups, and like to what extent and which ones are the most important?
I think yes. I mean, the model hasn't changed from forever. you have to prove that you know what you know. And you have to, I know we software engineers have a horrible reputation of being introverts. The truth is, we're all introverts. And so when you get a whole bunch of introverts together, we all magically are extroverts. They're like, oh, I'm like, you never know how introverted you are till you get a group of introverts together. And then you're like, am I an extrovert?
Right. Like, you're the most extroverted of this group of extreme introverts.
I'm that social because like I run meetups, like I host events, and then I turn around and say, oh, I hate people. I don't want to go to the store today. You know, those kinds of things. Like, am I an introvert? Yeah, I don't like, but I do like certain things that excite me, and meetups excite me. 100%. I don't know podcast. I don't know if it depends on your interest. If you enjoy AV stuff and creating content, yeah, create a podcast. I don't care. Podcast your journey. Like that, we would love that. Just do live vlogs, do Instagram daily updates of your journey to try and find a job. I think creating content is a valuable way to show your skills and to advertise yourself. If you best advertise yourself audiovisually, like I do, that's why I would stream my software on Twitch, because that's where I'm the most comfortable. I am not as comfortable writing blog posts. If you express yourself best with words, talk about what you hacked on this weekend in a blog post. One of my most popular blog posts is the scripts I run to set up my Mac OS. And this is literally setting up Brew. What do I install from Brew? Setting up Vim. What do I install from Vim? Just like different steps for installation. And that is probably my most liked Medium post. And it's just like, that's what people want to know. They want to know what new software you installed and if you liked it. Like, do you like Arch Browser? Great. Why? Like, that's all we want to know.
Yeah.
And 100%, I used to, pre-pandemic and a little bit during the pandemic, it got really hard during the pandemic, but pre-pandemic, I would go to a boot camp every 3 months and I would talk to their cohorts and I'd say, and all I did was talk about going to meetups. I like, there were probably at least 30 to 40 local meetups in Utah at the time. And I said, if you want a job, you go to these meetups. And it's not to say, hey, I'm looking for a job. It's because that way you meet the people who are hiring. The people that go to these jobs are hiring managers. We used to get a lot more recruiters than we do now, but they want to refer you. Your friends want to refer you to jobs.
Yeah.
And the only way to make friends is to go to meetups. And then it's so natural and easy to socialize with people who have the same interests as you. Like, you can go to a meetup and be like, whoa, you, like, you'll talk about weird things. You'll be like, oh, you also use a Linux laptop instead of a Mac? Or, oh, you like Macs? Or, oh, I've never thought about building a video game in Go. I love it. That was one of our talks, was somebody wrote a video game in Go, a Game Boy Advance game that you could run on emulators. And it was so cool. And all of the nerds that play video games now want to do that. Or talk about your, like, there are so many nerds with so many interests. I've had a talk of somebody who, like, yeah, I wrote a Go library to edit my images for me. So they would do SVG edits on image, editing the SVG library. Great. So you like visual input. Like, there's so many facets and interests. And once you make those people with similar interests, you'll never have to look for a job. Like, after my first job, I got my second job from a meetup. I got my third job because I host a conference and the people recognized my conference. I got my most recent job because of meetups, because I go to so many meetups and people know who I am. Like,
yeah.
And I'm not saying you have to run them. I love when people who don't have experience speak, because it's new. Like, yeah. I love when people share what they do. I do not care how professional it is. I just want to see your demo. Like, that's all I want to see. I want to see you run that code you worked on so hard so I can clap and applaud for you. But, like, if you want to get a job, you have to find your community. I don't care if your community's online, but the best communities are local in person. That is my unbiased opinion.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Online community is like a good placeholder. If you have nothing else, you have online.
You talked about tech Twitter. I have met people on tech Twitter, and they are good friends of mine. We don't interact via tech Twitter exclusively, but you had Bill Kennedy on your podcast.
Yeah.
I met him on tech Twitter, and we interact via tech Twitter, and he came to my conference because of our Twitter friendship, right? Like, I'm not saying don't use online communities, but he came to my conference. He came to that local meetup. I'm saying leverage it in your local community, because at the end of the day, that's where you're getting your jobs. I don't care if you work remote. The jobs you want are local. The people you want to meet are the jobs that are most convenient for you will be local jobs. Otherwise, you'll be traveling a lot.
I always say that at least for your first job, especially for your first job, it's easiest to go local, because you can make those very human connections to overcome that gap of like, you know, we're taking a chance on you. And it's harder to take a chance on
it's easier to ask for help
across the world. Yeah.
I've had jobs where I've said, hey, I'm blocked on Slack, because we didn't have in person. It was fully remote. Hey, I'm blocked. DM, hey, I'm blocked. And radio silence for 2 days, and I couldn't do anything.
Yeah.
Like, I'd gotten to the point where I literally could not move forward without somebody checking a box. That wouldn't happen in person.
Right. Yeah, you'd like spin around in your chair and get it figured out.
And so, yeah, I think there is value. I work remote. I'm not saying don't work remote, but I do think that the local community is your best support, even for getting remote jobs.
Yeah.
Like, you could work for Google remote and come to your local community and learn something you would never learn at Google, and then bring it to work and make your work better.
Yeah. Do you see any issues? Are there any issues with the conferences you run? Like, things you want people to be aware of? Or, like, you know, is there anything that you would change about meetups?
Yeah. I wrote a blog post about this a couple years ago called Local Communities Are Dead. And they, like, 2021, we didn't wait. As soon as buildings let us back in, we started having meetups again. And we did... we had ability to social distance. People wore masks. We did hybrid meetups. But people didn't attend. They didn't even attend virtually. And they quit attending virtually. And so now meetups that had 30 people, 15 in person, 15 remote, now only have 15 in person. Like, people do not attend virtual meetups.
Hmm.
And it's sad. Pre-COVID, I would run a meetup, and we would get 40 to 50 people every month. And they were always, like, they weren't the same people every time. And the conversations that you have and the people that you meet, and you can bounce ideas off each other. And people say, hey, I'm trying to build XYZ in Kubernetes. Have you ever seen that? And I'll be like, no, tell me about your problem. I'd love to learn about your problem. Like, I met so many more people. People found jobs easier. We would stop. And like, now I say, hey, is anybody hiring? We have one person hiring because there's only 15 people in the room.
Right.
When I go to the Slack that I manage for Forge Utah, the nonprofit one, we'll get 10 posts a week. So people are hiring. They're just not showing up to say, hey, I'm hiring. And that's really destructive for local growth, right? Like, if you want to help junior developers get careers, we need to have senior people go to meetups to mentor these people. I'm not saying you have to formally mentor them, but you can answer their questions. They'll have questions.
Right.
Or you'll learn skills. A lot of people will have, I need to learn. We're trying to migrate to the cloud. I need to learn about the cloud. We'll come to a meetup about the cloud. Like, or you'll come to a meetup about Go and we'll talk about the cloud the whole time. Like, we'll have these conversations after the talk that are super beneficial. And the less people that come to meetups, the less skilled the local community is. So I think Utah has the potential to have the same high level caliber skill reputation that San Francisco has. I know we have the people with the experience. We have people that worked at Bell Labs who live here.
Right.
But they're never going to be able to share that knowledge if we don't have a local community to share it. Again, I don't care if it's a local online community. I don't care, but we have to have that local interaction. And that's what I think post pandemic, people aren't coming back to that. People would come to a meetup every month and they haven't been to a meetup for 3 years because they got out of the routine and because they don't work in the office anymore.
Right. Sounds like the biggest issue is just the people aren't going.
People don't
they need
come
to go.
Back.
Just go to meetups. Yeah. Okay.
And every time I have a conference, like conferences, people make time for it. And they say, this was so nice. I haven't been to anything in 3 years. I really miss this. And I'm like, I have meetups every month. You don't have to miss this.
Yeah. Go to meetups. I love this advice.
Especially if you're new. Every job I've gotten is because of a meetup. It's not because I'm special. It's because I go to meetups and I shake people's hands. Yeah. You don't have to shake hands. You just have to say, hi, I am.
Right. If you don't want to shake hands, you don't actually have to.
No.
I love that. Thank you so much for coming on. You mentioned you stream on Twitch. You do a bunch of other things.
Do.
Go ahead and plug everything so people can find you.
So I am taking a little bit of a break from streaming to focus on my O'Reilly content. I will be back eventually, but you can watch past streams on my YouTube. They're all there. You can follow me on LinkedIn or Twitter. But like the best thing, honestly, would just be to join the Forge Slack. It's at forgeutah.tech. It's the website. Click the link. Come hang out with us. It's not just for people in Utah. It's for everybody. But like we have conversation about every topic. Machine learning, Go, Kubernetes, data engineering, a lot of soft skill stuff. That's where I talk to all my Raspberry Pi friends. I only have 2 Raspberry Pis. But I bought the second one because somebody posted that they were in stock on the Forge Slack.
They're always out of stock.
I spend a lot more time on LinkedIn just because that's where the data community is right now, is on LinkedIn. Hmm. But I'm on everything. I am literally on... No, I'm not on Mastodon. I don't do that.
Okay. Well, but, fantastic. I'll link all that stuff down in the show notes.
Yeah, please do. Yeah, and you can follow me on Twitch for when I start streaming again. I just needed a mental break from that.
Totally get it. Thank you so much for coming on. We'll talk to you later.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.